It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge has denied a request to postpone next week's election amid the novel coronavirus outbreak. And now Governor Evers is calling for lawmakers to allow a mail-in election with a timeline extended to next month. We'll talk about the case, the judge's decision, and what it'll mean for next Tuesday. First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're talking about Native American food traditions and how they're being maintained in Wisconsin today. Our next guest works with tribal seed savers, farmers, and restaurants to reconnect people to their roots through food and cooking, and she has some recipes to share with us as well. Elena Terry is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and executive chef at Wild Berries, a Madison-based nonprofit she started to keep indigenous food traditions alive and empower tribal communities through food sovereignty. She also works with the Intertribal Agriculture Council for the Great Lakes region, and she's food and culinary coordinator for the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us some about what inspired you to do the work you're doing with keeping these food traditions alive?
Well, I think first and foremost, it just feels good to be connected through food and to be able to utilize these ingredients on the level that I do and to have access. It's just an amazing thing. I love going to work every day.
Can you talk about some of the ingredients you've been working with and that Native American communities have, cared for and stewarded over the generations?
Absolutely. Well, one of the main things are the three sisters, so the corn, the beans, and the squash. And there are so many varieties being kept from, you know, multiple nations across the states and really the Americas. And so the corn is always fascinating. In this region, we're lucky enough to have wild rice, and there are so many different varieties of rice as well. And it's really neat to be able to have that when it has been traditionally processed. And the flavor is just incredible. And the beans, there's so many varieties from a deep dark purple to a small white bean. It's just really neat to be able to see how different the regions have ingredients that vary, but they're all similar.
For a lot of us, our cooking starts in the kitchen and at the grocery store or farmer's market. You are going back further on the supply chain, I understand, and helping make sure that there are seeds for what we might call heirloom varieties and things like that, that farmers are connecting with these seeds and growing some of these ingredients. Can you talk about some of your efforts?
Absolutely. So with the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance, we also work with the Indigenous Seed Keepers Network. And they really are the ones that care for these seeds. It's pretty amazing that we are able to trace back the ancestry of these seeds for hundreds of years and know where they were grown, even sometimes what families specifically grew these seeds. So to have those be able to make it through, you know, the moves that Indigenous people endured or, you know, displacements and still be able to have those ingredients that are ancestral, that, you know, have kind of carried us and nourished us through the years, it's amazing. So we like to get those out to the communities and, you know, support them. They also have a program where they have a rematriation where these seeds are going back to their home tribes and communities and kind of being gifted back so that they can have those ingredients again.
Wow. Can you tell us a couple of the stories of those seeds, the particular crops, the particular food items we're talking about?
Absolutely. So for just personally, I have a seed saver that is an amazing farmer and grower, and she grows out certain ingredients for me every year. And we had corn in different varieties that were Ho-Chunk, and then we were able to get Ho-Chunk squash that can be traced back a few hundred years. And that came last year. And we were saying to complete the sisters, we really needed to find a bean, but even the Smithsonian seed keeping didn't have a trace of a Ho-Chunk bean. But out of the blue last year, a bean came to me in the mail from one of my friends in Kentucky that is a steward of seeds. And it was just amazing to see that, you know, we were looking for them, and then all of a sudden they came. And it's really a neat acknowledgement. Some tribes even give their seeds, tribal enrollment to protect them and to give them rights to make sure that they will continue.
We're talking to Elena Terry on this week's edition of Food Friday. Elena is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and founder and executive chef at the Madison-based nonprofit Wild Berries. I want to check out one of the recipes you've shared with us, Elena. We've got that online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, one of my favorite times of year is fall. I love squash, and you've got this Sasquatch recipe shared with us. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, so squash is my favorite ingredient, and I really think it's underutilized, so I like to kind of put it on the forefront, and it's really a delicious dessert, and we use flaxseed instead of eggs, so it really is vegetarian, and I think we have a nut crust on there, so it kind of gives it a crispy bottom with some cranberries is what holds it together, and it gives it just a little bit of sweetness. And then the main sweetener is maple syrup. So everything is regional to us in that recipe.
And it ends up being a squash, as you said, with kind of a nutty crust, and it's sweet. It's got kind of a autumn spice package going in it.
Yeah, it's similar to a pumpkin pie, but there's not like a pie crust. It's a nut crust instead. And then the squash just gives it a different, almost slightly savory flavor as well. It's really delicious. I'd recommend trying it to anybody that can access that recipe.
It sounds really good, and you made a statement that I agree with as much as anything I've ever heard on this show. Squash is underutilized. Can you talk about some of the other great ways we can use our various kinds of winter squash? I know I'm dreaming a few months ahead here.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, it preserves really well, and you can dehydrate it even and make that into flour to use. There are so many different ways to utilize all these different varieties of squash, from, you know, the seeds to even being able to eat the skin on some of them. A simple roast even will highlight the flavor. But there are so many different varieties and so many different even textures and their ability to absorb water. So some of them I like to use it as a soup base, where some of them I would like to roast and maybe put into a casserole. So there's so many different varieties and ways to treat a squash. I would just encourage people. It's not super difficult, although there are some pests that like to eat the squash as well, but it does thrive. And so it's something that you can grow at home and then use throughout really almost until the winter time and through winter if you preserve it well enough.
Squash flour. I don't think I've ever even heard of that.
Yeah. So we dehydrate the squash and then, make it into a powder after that. And you can use that as a thickening agent for soup or to flavor breads. It's really a neat ingredient.
Well, I know you do the work with seed saving, and of course, I know you work on the cooking end of things. Is this something else you work with people on, bringing back or preserving food preservation and processing techniques?
Yes. So Wild Berries actually is a community outreach nonprofit where we work with tribal members who are overcoming alcohol and other drug abuse issues or emotional issues, and just give them a way to reconnect to our community through food. You know, everybody has this need to eat, and being able to prepare a meal for your community really gives you accountability and ownership, and it's a great way to link back when, you know, I think all of us at some point have suffered some sort of a disconnect, and it's a great way to offer a bridge back to the community. So we work on that with Wild Berries, and also with educating the greater community on these ingredients, getting them into the household. I personally believe that the more our ancestral ingredients are talked about, are grown, are utilized, the better chance they have for sustainability and that they will be there for future generations.
We're talking with Elena Terry, member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, executive chef at the nonprofit. She was just talking about Wild Berries. We're talking about indigenous ingredients, especially here in the Wisconsin area, and tribal food sovereignty on this week's edition of Food Friday. We've got some recipes from Elena at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can join in at 800 800- 888-642-1234. Are the foods we've been talking about so far part of your own family history or tribal history? Do certain foods make you feel connected to your roots? Do you think it's important to be connected to the ingredients we use from seed to harvest? And have you done things like a seed saving using heirloom ingredients that are local to your part of the state or the region? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Elena Terry, executive chef of the nonprofit Wild Berries, about maintaining tribal food traditions in Wisconsin today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are ingredients indigenous to Wisconsin a part of your family history, maybe your tribal history? Do you have a question about some of the ingredients, the seeds, the techniques Elena is talking about? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find a couple recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. That squash one we were talking about earlier, and another really good one. I'll tease that. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Right now, let's go to your calls. William is with us in Milwaukee. William, hello.
Hello there.
What do you want to tell us about, William?
I actually worked for Potawatomi for a good few months last year, and during that time, we had an Indigenous Foods Month, and at the big celebration there, I actually had the wonderful opportunity to talk with a someone who works here in Milwaukee who is actually part of a Seed Saver program, and they were kind enough to gift to me both a single cob of Oaxacan corn and a couple pods of this heirloom beans that I've sadly forgotten the name of. And today I'm actually going to be planting them in a Three Sisters garden. So I just wanted to share that and know that, hey, I want to try and keep these traditions alive, even though I'm not technically tribal myself.
William, thank you so much for sharing that story. Elena, a Three Sisters garden. That sounds great.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'm glad that you're taking the initiative and you feel a connection to those seeds and the responsibility to grow them. So, good for you. I'm glad that you have that opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit more about corn, Elena. I think we have a couple varieties that we run into in grocery stores and might not think of corn as having a ton of variety behind it. Could you open our eyes a little bit to the world of corn that is available to us?
Oh, corn. Yes, absolutely. So the corn that we use primarily isn't what you would get in the grocery store. It would be more of the colored corn that you'd see at the fall harvest time. And that can range in so many different ways. I could talk corn all day, but we have growers that grow out things from a pure white variety, which the Oneidas have, and it's a beautiful corn, to, a strawberry red popcorn that is still an ancestral corn. So there's different ways of processing that corn for different ways of utilizing it, and just to make sure that it'll be preserved for the long haul. So you can save it on the cob, like William had mentioned, and use that for seed, or you could use that dried corn and nixtamalize it and make it into hominy. You could also partially boil it while it's still in the milky stage and then take it off the cob and dry it, and then that would be like a soup corn. So there's a lot of different ways that you can utilize all these different corns, and even from coloring, a black corn that has a higher sugar content, or a bright purple corn that you would use for flour. There's so many different varieties. But if you like corn, I definitely encourage you to do some research and to find out how incredibly diverse it is in different regions and how many different kinds there are instead of just the sweet corn that you're used to.
William, thanks a lot for the call. I'll drop by for dinner maybe mid-September. Let's go back to your calls now. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering how much your guest feels about foraging for mushrooms. I've been doing this for years, and we get about 6 months of foraging in Wisconsin for different types of mushrooms coming out now in early spring and all the way through October. And, of course, then ramps as well.
All right. Foraged mushrooms, Elena.
Yes. I mean, I'm anxiously awaiting morels to pop up because I've just talked to one of my friends in Oklahoma who had an incredible harvest, and I was a little jealous. So, yes, those ingredients, I mean, they offer such a different flavor, and it's something that is from nature. I would just make sure to put it out there that when you do forage and you do take from the land, that you do it in a responsible way and that you don't over forage, you know, especially when it comes to something like ramps that people do appreciate, and it does have such a unique flavor, and you can dehydrate that and preserve it, but just to make sure to do it responsibly and that there is enough to continue on.
Thanks for that call. Elena, let's talk some more about that, because I know that's part of your effort too, the seeds that we grow on purpose, but can you also talk about stewardship of these wild ingredients that we use, but as you say, don't want to overuse?
Yeah, so the ingredients that come from the forest, especially in times like this where, you know, food sovereignty is at the forefront of a lot of conversations. And there is a lot, especially in the state of Wisconsin, that you can get from the woods and, you know, from the land naturally. So many different kinds of varieties of mushrooms or even asparagus, berries. They're all very plentiful, but it is a matter of making sure that you don't ever over harvest so that they will be able to come back the next year or that they will have seeds to disperse and they can continue to thrive. So it is something that you have to be aware of, but it shouldn't be a deterrent. And to make sure that where you do go, it's either on, you know, land that it is approved to be doing that on, to be harvesting something from.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Elena Terry with the Madison-based nonprofit Wild Berries. She's also food and culinary coordinator for the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance. I want to turn now, Elena, to the other recipe you shared with us. We have this up at WPR.org/Food Friday. This looks so good and pretty simple. Bison meatballs. Can you tell us about these?
Yeah. So the bison meatballs, we did a casino takeover at Ho-Chunk Casino in Wisconsin Dells, and it was one of the things that we featured on the buffet, and it is wonderful. Bison is a really good alternative red meat to beef, and the health benefits for that, consuming it, is a lot better because it is a lean meat. But when you do a lean meat like that, you want to add some extra, you know, moisture. So I added the dried berries to that. And it just ends up being, you know, where you can sear all sides of it and let it roast for just a couple minutes. It's a wonderful, wonderful meatball. And, you know, my family loves when we have meatballs and make that one.
Now, on this ingredient list, I want to amplify one ingredient here. You've got the bison, okay, wild rice. That makes a lot of sense. I want to key in on dried blueberries in the meatballs. What are they going to do there?
Yeah, so they'll add not only flavor and texture, but moisture, and they also help bind the meat together. So it kind of helps hold it differently than, say, a breadcrumb.
That sounds fantastic. Again, if your mouth's watering, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Elena, I want to get back to your work now with Wild Berries. And I should say, if people are looking for that online, it's spelled B-E-A-R-I-E-S. The people you work with, as you said, might be facing challenges in their lives, connecting to these food traditions, helping them out. Can you tell us more about, you know, the people who come through the program and what they get out of it?
Absolutely. So like I mentioned before, I think that all of us can say at some point we felt a disconnect from, you know, maybe family or community. And for a lot of cultures, not only indigenous people, sharing a meal is one of the highest things that you could do for somebody, you know, and welcoming them to your home or to the community. And this just gives a way for our participants to show that kind of ownership back to the community and teach life skills. We talk about budgeting, about sourcing ingredients, and then a way to show pride and to share that knowledge. And it really is about sharing knowledge. So it is ultimately a mentorship program where regardless of whatever level, I think that we all also have been affected at some point from alcohol and other drug abuse issues, if it isn't personally something that you struggle with, it's affected all of us on some level. So really what I wanted to do was make it a nurturing space for the participants to come and know that there wasn't judgment, but we would help, you know, along the way and give support. And really ultimately that support ends up being support for the knowledge on continuing these food systems.
And then when people come through the program, do they go out and take these traditions on to other people?
Absolutely. That's one of the expectations, is that, you know, if you entered this program and it's a good way and you gain something, it's a responsibility of yours now to share that knowledge in the same, you know, positive environment and in a good way so that the knowledge continues. And that's how it has been passed down for generations, so that we're able to still have it now.
In our last few moments, Elena, you know, spring headed on to summer. What ingredient are you really excited about this time of year?
Ooh, this time of year. I mean, I'm really excited to get out into the woods and get some of those morels in the ramps. And then also, I mean, there's so many different seasonings, from sumac to cedar, that you can get. And just watching them all come back and kind of wake up after winter, it is an exciting time of year. So I think getting out into the woods is going to be something that I'm really looking forward to. And then I'm really excited to see what my growers are going to be putting in the ground for me here in the next couple weeks as well.
Elena, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a wonderful conversation.
That's Elena Terry, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and executive chef and founder of the nonprofit Wild Berries. She also works with the Intertribal Agriculture Council, and she's the food and culinary coordinator for the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance. She talked to us about how she's working with other people to keep indigenous food traditions alive here in Wisconsin. Find the recipes we talked about, the bison meatballs and that squash recipe. Find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up after the news, next Tuesday's election is the focus of court cases and last-minute action at the state and local levels. We'll get the latest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers ordered Wisconsinites to stay inside mostly, but how do police factor into enforcing that rule? We'll talk to a Wisconsin police chief to learn more about the work they're doing. First, a federal judge has denied requests from various groups to postpone the April 7th election as the COVID-19 outbreak continues here in Wisconsin and around the world. Judge William Conley said in his ruling yesterday that it wasn't appropriate for a judge to make the decision, and criticized Governor Evers and state Republicans for not taking steps to push back the election. Conley did extend two deadlines that could make casting a ballot on Tuesday easier for voters statewide, and Conley ruled that clerks could not release the results before April 13th. That was yesterday. Now, Governor Evers is urging the legislature to convene in special session tomorrow to consider allowing a mail-in spring election and extending the due date along the way. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Wisconsin Public Radio News Team. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, this story is moving fast, Sean. It might be changing while we're talking right now. What is the latest? We'll start here from Governor Evers on this.
Yeah, I feel like there's a very good chance that we'd have a development like in the next 10 minutes or so. So the latest from Governor Evers is he called a special session to, you know, as you mentioned, delay this election. And this is significant because, you know, it's a special session call, which is kind of procedurally, a significant step for a governor to take. But I think it's especially significant because this is the first time that we've heard Governor Evers say that this election needs to be delayed. He has in the past, about a week ago, called for a move to an all mail-in election. But Republicans balked at that. They said there's no way that the state could actually achieve that in such a short period of a time. And elections officials largely backed them up on that. This is different. He's calling for a delay of the election until May 19th. And that would give the state more time to print and mail absentee ballots to more than 3 million people, or at least to the millions who haven't requested them on their own already.
So that's a big change
from a big change,
we're going to vote on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, and to be determined on whether this is something that the legislature goes along with as of this moment that we're speaking, and I expect this could change at any point, but Republicans have not yet said whether they will support this. So what if they don't? You know, and they say that this is too late in the game, we can't make this change right now. Evers was asked about this a few times today at a briefing that he attends a few times a week with the Department of Health Services. And he said that if they take no action, we'll be looking at whatever action we can take. So, you know, essentially it would really come down to the governor then if the legislature didn't act, because a federal court has said that it's not going to delay the election. Evers is now putting it in kind of the legislature's lap. And if they say no, then it's kind of up to him to decide whether this thing moves forward. And if it moves forward, it's going to be unlike any election we have ever experienced.
The line so far, I think from everybody, I think including Governor Evers even, is that the governor single-handedly can't change an election date in Wisconsin. Am I right? That's the impression I've been hearing from everybody?
That's what he said, and he has said pretty consistently for a long time now that this election needs to happen, because this is not just a presidential primary that we're talking about in Wisconsin. Other states have delayed their elections because that's what they're voting on, is a presidential nominating contest. Evers has said, and Republican lawmakers have been on the same page about this, that this election is going to be for a state Supreme Court race, other judgeships, other local offices throughout the state, and that they need to be filled, and this election has to happen. So, you know, I think that's the significant difference that he has pointed out when he's been talked about this before. He's now saying that because of the public health emergency, you've got this surge of COVID-19 cases, is the word he used, in southeast Wisconsin. And you couple that with the decision by the Milwaukee election officials to close most of their polling places. He's saying you're creating a public health situation, basically, a dangerous public health situation, and so that has forced his hand.
Sean Johnson is with us, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at next Tuesday's possible election day, court orders coming out here, or a special session called by the governor for lawmakers to try to bump this thing back and turn it into a mail-in election. Well, Sean, let's set the governor and lawmakers aside for the moment. The current state of affairs is what came out from this judge yesterday. Talk about his decision, his ruling.
Yeah, the judge yesterday from the ruling yesterday from Judge William Connolly was very critical of the governor and the legislature for not delaying the election. I mean, he put it on them, saying that they had created a dangerous public health situation for the public and for poll workers who are going to be asked to, against the advice that the government is giving them right now, to avoid crowds, that they're going to be asked to go out and join crowds to vote, basically. But Connolly said that the legislature and the governor should have delayed the election, but that it was not his call as a federal judge to delay an election. He said that Supreme Court cases had made it clear that wasn't his decision to make. But what Connolly did do is he extended the amount of time people have to return absentee ballots. Before he ruled, that deadline for absentee ballots to be received was election night at 8 p.m., so April 7th at 8 p.m. Under Connolly's order, they could be received all the way up until April 13th, the Monday after the election, at 4 p.m. And so, you know, that was a significant step. And also because of the way that he worded his ruling, those ballots would not have to be postmarked by Election Day. In fact, they could also be returned by hand or in a drop box after Election Day.
And that's another big change. Now, there has been some response to the change in deadlines for absentee ballots. What have we heard about that, Sean?
Yeah, as far as the other change in deadline for absentee ballots is that the judge's order extended it to today, to the deadline for absentee ballots. It was yesterday that if you wanted to request one, you had until 5 p.m. yesterday. He extended that till today at 5 p.m.
Yeah, are Republicans happy with the later deadline for those ballots to be returned and counted?
Republicans appealed his ruling almost immediately, and one of the things that they were really focused on was the idea that because he had set this April 13th date for returning his ballots, and he hadn't required the ballots to be postmarked, that you have sort of a kind of an election that never ends. I mean, it would end on April 13th, but it's not like your typical election where you count the ballots on April 7th and you decide who won. They're saying that it raises the prospect that people, you have this kind of rolling count. And the other issue that they had nothing to do with the deadlines that Connolly was dealing with. It had to do with a provision that he also essentially repealed, where if you vote absentee under current law, you're supposed to get a signature from somebody who witnesses the ballot. You know, Connolly said that is basically impossible for some people to achieve right now because they're being confined by COVID-19. And so if they can't get a witness signature, they should still be allowed to cast their absentee ballots. Republicans have challenged that, said that he's trying to rewrite laws that were passed by legislature, signed by a governor.
And Sean, in the meantime, I understand we're getting an avalanche of absentee ballots already coming in on this one, right?
You've had an avalanche of requests, that's for sure. You've had more than 1.1 million absentee ballots requested as of yesterday. The number of ballots returned, you know, again, as of the latest statistics, was nowhere near that high. And so what you could see is that, you know, assuming a large number of those people do return them in coming days, it's going to kind of overwhelm election workers at a time when they are also dealing with an in-person election that is, you know, being conducted under social distancing, is being conducted in, you know, very unusual times. And so that's kind of what Judge Connolly's order was addressing. But because of what's happening today with Governor Evers' order and everything else, you know, we'll see, we'll see what next Tuesday brings.
We'll leave it there for now, Sean. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
It's a roller coaster. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us today to talk about a judge's decision yesterday to not postpone next week's election amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Then the request today from Governor Evers for lawmakers to get to work tomorrow, effectively delay the election and turn it into a mail-in election instead. More twists and turns to come, I'm guessing, today and over the weekend. You can keep following the latest breaking news over at WPR.org/news. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, spring is a time for a lot of people to make the first trip of the year to their cabins in northern Wisconsin, but officials there are urging people to hold off on making that trip for now. We'll find out what doctors and county leaders have to say. Now, it was just last week that Governor Evers put a safer at home order in place, urging Wisconsinites to only travel outside their homes for essential things like groceries, prescriptions, and hospital visits. But how is that order actually being enforced? We wanted to find out more about how law enforcement is involved in making sure people are actually following that order. Sean Marsky is chief of police for the village of Sturtevant and the immediate past president of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. Chief Marsky, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Before we get into enforcement, Chief Marsky, I know police officers are essential employees. They're out on the job. What kind of things are we doing to make sure that they're safe, they're as protected as they can be from this virus?
That's a good question, Rob. What we've done is statewide made sure that we get the appropriate personal protection equipment that our officers as well as all first responders need. There is some shortages throughout the state, but working with emergency management and working with the Office of the Governor, we're trying to fill those gaps so that all of our first responders have the appropriate equipment to protect themselves while they're helping others.
All right, now let's get into enforcing this safer at home order. I'm guessing you and your colleagues around the state are getting a lot of questions about that. Are there any misconceptions, first of all, that you'd want to clear up about police officers and this safer at home order?
Absolutely. This is not a traditional enforcement activity. Of course, this is something new to all of us. I was on a conference call with the governor just a few days ago, and it's a new thing for them as well. This is not an enforcement as we're going around and writing citations or anything like this. This is true community policing where we're trying to keep the citizens in our community safe and healthy. And in that regards, what we're trying to do is just educate. This is really an education initiative that when we see violations of the safer at home order, we just try to get people to comply for their own health and their own safety and have them, you know, operate in a better manner when officers encounter them.
This is a message I think I've seen from your colleagues around the state and various law enforcement agencies, that they're really hoping that the public gets ahead of them on this one and just follows this order.
Absolutely. Through our social media, through our police department websites, our Facebook, et cetera, we just want to keep educating people. And everybody has seen what they should be doing. And if all of a sudden they, you know, are in a situation where maybe they're not cognizant and they're in a group together somewhere, law enforcement, it's our role just to have them, hey, try to operate in a safer manner, use that social distancing that we've all heard about. But it's certainly not an enforcement type of activity in the traditional sense.
Right. The order includes saying, hey, if you have essential needs, a grocery store, going to an essential job, that kind of thing, you can travel. There's no law enforcement effort now or anticipated to check with everybody who's out in public, right?
Not at all. And if we were to do something like that, we would be actually violating that social distancing as well. We're just trying to keep people healthy in our communities and keep them safe. Flatten that curve, and let's just really work on this all together. It's the true principle of community policing, where the police are certainly partnering with the community.
Talking to Sean Marschke, Chief of Police for the Village of Sturtevant, immediate past president of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. We're talking about the safer at home order in Wisconsin and police enforcement, as we're hearing, not direct enforcement, more of an educational effort at this point. Chief Marschke, I've seen in other states cases where people who haven't heeded these warnings and often after repeated suggestions from police officers still convening large groups, that we do then see some kind of enforcement. Is that something that could potentially happen here in Wisconsin?
It certainly could, but we would want to work collectively where if that was continuing, we keep that dialogue open with wherever that gathering would be, and try to use other means to get them to comply with the order. For example, if we had a business that refused to close, we work with them in trying to get them to comply, maybe working with, the licensing and that kind of thing. Luckily, we have not found that. When we've had businesses that are necessary to close, simply law enforcement has made contact with them and we've gotten compliance. It's been cooperation. It's truly good to see here in Wisconsin that we're not having those problems that you described, Rob.
I wonder if you could give us a feeling for the daily life of police officers in your own community right now. We've got this COVID-19 thing going on, but I imagine police are doing the same things they were doing last month, last year, whenever.
There is. There's actually a reduction in our calls for service because many people are certainly at home. They're not out traveling. They're doing what they're supposed to do. So we've seen a reduction in our calls for service, reduction in traffic crashes, et cetera. What we have heard from our citizens and that they enjoy is that they see the police officers patrolling many of the residential areas. It helps give them that feeling of security that we certainly are out there and we're in this all together.
And we have communities from the very smallest to our biggest cities. As you talk to your colleagues at other law enforcement agencies, is it different from place to place?
It really isn't. It's something that we've never seen before. That we're not seeing. Is the amount of traffic we're not seeing. The amount of activity that you normally will because people are following the order and they're trying to stay safe. So it's something that's new to all of us but with law enforcement agencies, big and small.
Now, going back to the protection of the officers themselves now, we've heard concerns about getting key medical supplies to, healthcare facilities, hospitals, and the like. Do you feel like you have a good enough flow of personal protective gear that your officers might need?
We have a need. There are certainly shortages and gaps, and the departments that are adequately stocked, our concern is how long we're going to be able to maintain those personal protective equipment stock within our department. So even if we have the current PPEs on hand, there is that concern about the future.
Now, if people out there have concerns, they want to follow the letter and spirit of the Safer at Home order, but they don't know what counts as an essential outing or an essential business. Do you have places you refer them to when they come and maybe ask you or your officers questions?
We certainly do. We have them go to the governor's website. Also, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation deals with the essential business side of the house. So we do send them to them, but they certainly always can call our non-emergency numbers as well if they have questions in their local jurisdictions.
And it's okay if you repeat yourself a little bit here. Can you share some of that educational message you were talking about earlier about what people can do to help make this go more smoothly?
Just follow those, follow those rules and those suggestions that all of us have heard. If there's a question, seek out the advice. Just try to stay safe. And like I said, we in law enforcement in Wisconsin, we're all in this together with the community.
Oh, I want to pass on along a question from a listener who wonders if this is community policing, why are there potentially $250 fines or 30 days in jail specified in the state order? Is that something you're looking at, Chief Marschke?
Hopefully not, and not that I have heard of. With all violations of state law, there's a penalty that's applied. No matter what the violation of the law is, there's always a penalty that's applied. And it's certainly there. We have the powers to use it. We don't want to use it. We want compliance because, after all, if we have to take enforcement action, well, we're not then socially distanced from anybody, and we just want everybody to be healthy. So, yes, the penalties are there. Like I said, here in Wisconsin, we hope not to use them.
Chief Marschke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Chief Sean Marschke of the Sturtevant Police Department. He's also the immediate past president of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. We talked to him today about the role of police agencies around the state in enforcing Governor Evers' Safer at Home order. As we heard, mostly educational, looking for the public to help out so that they don't need to do a lot of enforcement. Well, we want to hear from you now. What do you see going on in your community? What do you see changing? Do you see people mostly observing this, not having big groups, big gatherings getting together? And how is this affecting day-to-day life in your own community? You can let us know a couple of different ways, actually. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And if you have something more along the line of a question, something you're curious about when it comes to this COVID-19 outbreak here in Wisconsin, there is a place for you too. WHISconsin, WHISconsin. That's at the WPR.org website. Pose your questions there. We've gotten a lot of them, and our various reporters and other staff around Wisconsin Public Radio are constantly hustling to give you answers to some of those questions. Let us know your questions at WHISconsin.org. Let us know what's going on in your community. Email ideas at WPR.org. Here's a stay-at-home challenge for you that combines your artistic ability, if you have some, unlike me, with your inner MacGyver-type skills to make do with whatever stuff you have around. The Getty Museum in Los Angeles called for people to recreate works of art using only household items. You can pull an image from their online collection and post it side-by-side with your own creation. And a lot of people have responded to their Twitter challenge. Here are just a few of the examples. One woman recreated an ancient Greek statue of a harp player, about a, 4,000-year-old statue, using her canister vacuum cleaner to fill in for the harp. A still-life painting of fish, cheese, and other foods is recreated in a photo, but with two cans of tuna taking the place of the actual fish. A Madonna and Child painting, very common theme, is recreated as a woman with a pug. An Impressionist streetscape comes to life as a kitchen floor with boxes and children's toys. And God and Adam, that famous image on the Sistine Chapel where they're reaching out their fingers toward each other, that was recreated by a photo of two dudes drinking beer on their front porch. You can see those and many, many more on the Getty Museum Twitter feed. And if you want some artistic inspiration, you can go to their image collection at getty.edu/art/collection. Artistic news you can use. This is Central Time.